content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Anna Kogal from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Glamour.com, and I have a little something special from the New York Times about dogs. Well, welcome back, everyone. I'm so happy to be with you again. Today is Thursday, May 23rd. Next week is, weekend is Memorial Day. Woohoo! All right, hope you had a great week. I'm really happy to be back with you. And this week we're going to start off kind of where we left off last week, a little bit anyway. Again, this is a story from, not a story, but an article from Glamour.com. And just the one last one here about pregnancy. A lot of people are, well, maybe trying to get pregnant or pregnant, whatever. And this one is an article entitled, Women Are Waiting Longer Than Ever to Get Pregnant. Do you have a plan for your fertility? Women deserve more transparency as they plan their reproductive futures, which is why Glamour partnered with Modern Fertility to take the pulse of what women do and don't know about fertility. Getting the facts isn't about adding more pressure to run to the nearest egg freezing clinic. It's about giving women more power to make the choices best for their bodies. All right, and this article was by Michaela McKenzie. It's 2019, and shockingly, little about the conversation about reproductive choice has changed. While the ominously ticking biological clock in older ads has been replaced by more empowering messages on Instagram, naturally, urging women to freeze their eggs for the cost of a manicure, the underlying message is the same. If you want kids one day, better hurry, because those ovaries aren't getting any younger. Science has made a bit more progress. Progress-assisted reproductive technologies like IVF have helped millions of women, and that's in vitro fertilization, become moms when getting pregnant naturally wasn't in the cards. And hormonal tests that can give you insight into your fertility future have gotten more accessible. But it can't erase the biological bottom line. Fertility declines with age. Women in their 30s are now officially having more babies than women in their 20s, according to CDC data. But technology may still not be keeping up with a sharp demographic shift. Women are putting off pregnancy. The average age of first pregnancy varies wildly across the country, but is steadily creeping upward. The national average age of first pregnancy back in 1970 was 21. In 2017, it was closer to 27. 27 is still young in reproductive terms. Fertility doesn't begin to enter the danger zone until the mid-30s. But many women, especially in big cities, are pushing the limits, getting closer and closer to the reproductive fringes. In Miami, the average age of first-time mothers is 30. Women in Manhattan are putting pregnancy off until 31. In San Francisco, first-time moms are 32 on average. Why women put off pregnancy or choose to skip it altogether doesn't really matter. Whether it's to wait for a promotion or the right partner, or just to feel ready for motherhood, that choice doesn't need to be justified. But it should also be made with all the facts. In your mid-20s, peak fertility years, the chances of getting pregnant naturally each time you ovulate are around 25%. But by 30, that number slips to 20%. At 35, it's around 15%. And by 40, your chances of getting pregnant naturally hover around 5%. The longer women wait, the less optimistic their reproductive chances. It's no wonder egg freezing, billed as the empowering way to take control of your future, is on the rise. We've done a really good job of pushing the conversation forward, and women are so much more proactive about it, says Jamie Knopman, MD, a board-certified reproductive endocrinologist and Directory of Fertility Preservation for CCRM, a fertility clinic in New York City. But on the flip side, I think we've created a little bit of hysteria. Proof? The vast majority of women who freeze their eggs never use them. One small study published in Human Reproduction in 2017 found the number of women who go on to fertilize and implant the eggs they put on ice might be as low as 6%. With average egg freezing costs between $30,000 and $40,000, that's a massive amount of potentially wasted cash. Whether egg freezing is a savvy move that is indeed empowering, or just another way to scare women into making certain decisions about their body, depends on why and when you're doing it. If you want to get pregnant at 30, your chances of conceiving naturally, which is exactly what happened to the majority of women in the study after icing their eggs, are still high. If you have other things on the agenda and don't foresee motherhood becoming a priority until you're pushing 40, it can be a smart move. So how did we get to this point where we're investing so much fear and angst and actual dollars into a maybe someday solution? Because we lack good information. What we know about our reproductive health and our basic fertility is woefully inadequate. 77% of women in a recent Glamour survey incorrectly thought health could trump age when it comes to reproductive odds. It doesn't. More on that later. Smart decisions can only be made with good information. So Glamour partnered with fertility testing company Modern Fertility to cut through the fear-mongering and misinformation and ask more than 300 women what they really know about the modern state of fertility. It turns out, despite the fact that we're talking about fertility more than ever, the facts are still elusive. Over 70% of the women we surveyed wish they knew more about the factors influencing their fertility future. Knowledge is the most important thing, says Dr. Knopman. You need to be educated in order to make good decisions down the road. Knowing what happens to your fertility and knowing that there are options and that not all options are created equal is important. Here's what you need to know about the modern state of fertility to save yourself serious debt and regret, whether you want to have kids now or in 10 years or aren't quite sure yet. Age does matter more than anything else. Age is the single most dominant factor in determining fertility and success with fertility treatments. It matters above all else, says Paula Brady, MD, assistant professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the Columbia University Irving Medical Center and reproductive endocrinologist at Columbia University Fertility Center. Women are born with all the eggs we'll ever have. So time takes its toll in a very real way, particularly after age 35. It seems there should be an override switch to neutralize Mother Nature as you pursue the here and now of your career, dating life, or personal journey to self-discovery. But the fact of the matter is no amount of yoga, organic meals, or cutting-edge tech can erase the effects of time on fertility. Age impacts two key factors of fertility, egg quantity and egg quality. The latter dictates how well eggs are primed for fertilization and are capable of seeding a healthy ongoing pregnancy. Both decline with age, but it's the drop-off in egg quality that really causes trouble. Over time, eggs start to accumulate little genetic changes that increase the risk of infertility and of miscarriage, Dr. Brady says. The risk rises continuously through the 30s, beginning a sharp swing around 35. It's not a cliff, Dr. Brady says. It's not like when you're 34.9. Things are going to be so much different than when you're 35.0. It's just a time to be aware that things start to change. Health is important, just not in the way you might think. The majority of women Glamour surveyed thought that being healthy could short-circuit a ticking biological clock. I hear that all the time. People are like, "But I eat organic," says Dr. Notman. Health does matter. It influences the health of your pregnancy. But your ovaries don't really care how many apples you eat in a day or if you always go to the gym, she says. Those things will make you healthy in your pregnancy, and that's a huge advantage. You have less risk of gestational diabetes and high blood pressure, but you will still have the same challenges actually getting pregnant. The major exception to the rule, smoking. A cigarette habit will do a number on just about every major health system. Your heart, your lungs, your skin, and even your reproductive system. Smoking kicks egg loss into overdrive. Women who smoke enter menopause an average of 1 to 4 years earlier than non-smokers. The verdict on vaping is still out. The problem with vaping is that everyone thinks it's not as bad as cigarettes, but we don't really know what it does yet, says Dr. Notman. Weight can also impact your chances of having a baby. That goes for male partners, too. Obesity in women increases the rate of miscarriage and is associated with worse outcomes for fertility treatments, Dr. Brady says. IVF is not a silver bullet. Success rates with IVF, or in vitro fertilization, often hailed as a magic bullet, hover around 5%. That's success rates for women in their early 40s. People are really shocked to hear that, Dr. Brady says. Really shocked. Fertility doctors see women every day who've been led to believe that egg freezing and IVF are insurance policies with limited risk and hopeful guarantees. IVF is revolutionary science that has allowed more than 8 million births to women who otherwise wouldn't have been able to get pregnant since the procedure was first pioneered in the 1980s. But most of the success of IVF is based on the age of the female, Dr. Notman says. The younger you are when you make the embryos, the better chance those embryos are going to be viable and lead to a viable pregnancy. It's far from fail-safe, but the technology and the ad campaign surrounding it has given an inflated sense of confidence about what fertility treatments can and can't do. People come in at 40 and say, "Oh, I'm going to do IVF," and I tell them, "Okay, but this may take us a lot of rounds, and it may not work," Dr. Notman says. In other words, you can't just throw money at the problem. It's not always a slam dunk, she says. It also matters where you do your IVF. This is a technically challenging procedure. Part art, part science. And not all IVF clinics are up to the challenge. Not all labs can do egg retrieval and storage the same way, Dr. Notman says. Lab conditions can alter the embryo. Before handing over your credit card, your body, or your dreams of future pregnancy, ask the clinic the right questions. How many eggs have you frozen? How many eggs have survived the thaw? How many eggs have made embryos? Look for a clinic associated with the Society of Assisted Reproductive Technology, which provides oversight and keeps tabs on a clinic's success rate. Taking hormonal birth control doesn't impact your fertility. One of the biggest myths I hear is that the pill hurts your fertility and that long-term pill use is not good, says Dr. Notman. That's not true. Let us repeat. Hormonal birth control, whether you use the pill, the ring, the patch, or a hormonal IUD, doesn't hurt your fertility. But it doesn't prolong it either. What birth control won't protect you from is egg loss, Dr. Notman says. Most of us are born with about 1 to 2 million eggs. By the time we get our first period, most of us have about 350,000 eggs. You lose a significant amount before you even menstruate. Each month, whether you're ovulating or not, around 1,000 eggs die off. Their cells absorbed back into your body. From the first period to the last period, you're constantly losing eggs, no matter what you do, says Dr. Notman. One factor that does impact your ovarian reserves, family history. Regardless of how far in the future your baby-making plans are, when you are ready to start thinking about fertility, you should talk to your mom before you talk to your gynecologist. Women who have had sisters or mothers who went through menopause early, around age 40, definitely should discuss that with their gynecologist, says Dr. Brady. It's not a death sentence for your ovaries, but it is a good opportunity for a little proactive fertility assessment. If your mom had an earlier menopause, and we think you might too, maybe you're a candidate to freeze your eggs, so in the future, there's less worry about what your ovaries are doing, Dr. Notman says. If you want to put a pin in pregnancy, you should have a plan. Conversations about fertility can be off-putting, as though they're yet another paternalistic conversation about what a woman should be doing with her body. Women don't want to feel oppressed by this biological clock feeling, Dr. Brady says. We have enough to worry about. The American Society of Reproductive Medicine tried to do some public awareness about reproductive aging years ago. Picture a baby bottle shaped like an hourglass, and it really did not go over well for these reasons. Today's cartoon eggs that are colonizing Instagram feeds aren't any better. But increasing your awareness of the factors influencing your fertility doesn't mean you should run to the nearest egg freezing clinic and slap down a credit card. Information, especially information about your body, is power. When we asked women what they would do if they found out they had fewer eggs than average for their age, 72% said they'd start a conversation with their doctor about what that means for them. Asking your OBGYN about factors in your health history that might tip the scales one way or the other is a good place to start. You can also get some insight with a blood test that measures hormones associated with the number of eggs you have. It's just one aspect of what goes into getting pregnant, but it's a good jumping-off point for a conversation with your doc. The important thing, this has to be a conversation that's had in context, says Dr. Notman. No single test can lay out your fertility future with complete certainty, just as no single decision, like freezing your eggs, can guarantee you'll beat the biological clock. Understanding your fertility isn't a single stat or snapshot, says Dr. Notman. It's an ongoing conversation. Okay, I told you I had something really fun about dogs to read you. Now, here it is. This is actually from the New York Times. Adjunct to our usual Glamour and Teen Vogue and so forth, but I think you'll really like this. So, why so many books about dogs? And this is by Vanessa Woods and Brian Hare. And what do they tell us about our relationship with canines and about ourselves? What would the world be like without music or rivers or the green and tender grass? The poet Mary Oliver asks in her book, Dog Songs. What would this world be like without dogs? A world without dogs is impossible to imagine. Our relationship with them predates the written word, agriculture, and civilization. They were our hunting buddies, bed warmers, and sometimes, if not much else was around, our dinner. As dogs crept into our homes, surfing kitchen counters and sleeping on the sofa, our focus was practical, managing the animal with which 60 million American households share space. That's about 13 million more households than the number cohabiting with the next popular, most popular pet, cats. Until surprisingly recently, most dog books were assiduously pragmatic. How to choose them, train them, and care for them. But the new millennium is different. Marley and Me, the 2005 mega bestseller by John Grogan, marked a subtle but important shift in how we think about dogs. It begins as a hilarious account of dog ownership in the 1990s. How do you get a large, muscled carnivore to sit nicely at a restaurant, remain tranquil during a thunderstorm, and not poop on the beach? But by the end of the book, Grogan is almost entirely concerned with his Labrador Marley's interior life, the way he thinks, feels, and apprehends the world. I dropped my forehead against his and sat there for a long time, as if I could telegraph a message through our two skulls from my brain to his. This somersault into Marley's mental landscape involves what researchers call theory of mind, your thoughts, feelings, and beliefs about the thoughts, feelings, and beliefs of others. Theory of mind is the root of some of our most profound experiences. Take love, for instance. It's just an abstraction unless you are able to wonder, does she love me too? What did he mean when he looked at me that way? Will she miss me when I'm gone? Since 2000, books exploring dog minds have proliferated at an astonishing rate. Currently, more than 70,000 books are listed on Amazon, including dozens of novels, many of them best-selling tearjerkers, such as The Art of Racing in the Rain by Garth Stein, narrated by Enzo, and Unfailingly Wise and Loyal Lab Mix, and A Dog's Purpose by W. Bruce Cameron, a tale also told by a dog, one that undergoes repeated incarnations as it arrives in a human's life and dispenses important lessons. The dog mind is also an increasingly prominent feature of literary fiction, from The Door by the Hungarian writer Magda Szabó, published in English to acclaim in 2015, featuring, among other characters, a dog that is, as Claire Messud put it in her review for the book review, as vivid and fully realized a character as any human, a truly great literary dog, to The Friend by Sigrid Nunez, in which a woman develops a quasi-romantic relationship with a dead friend's Great Dane. Nunez's book won last year's National Book Award for Fiction. Now, there's even a thoughtful political book in The Form of a Human-Canine Mind Meld, Don't Label Me, by Irshad Manji, a writer and activist, which unfolds as a conversation between the author and her dog, Lily, about divisive social issues like identity, diversity, and religious politics. To do diversity honestly, we can't be labeling all of diversity's critics as bigots, Manji tells her dog. You disagree, Lil? You're entitled to your opinion, but you haven't let me explain mine. The spate of mind-focused books raises the question, After 14,000 years of living with dogs, why are we only now getting around to considering what goes on inside their heads? There are many possible explanations, but one is that the last two decades, science has discovered more about dog cognition than in the previous two centuries combined. From 1900 to 1999, most cognitive researchers dismissed dogs as uninteresting because they believed domestication had led to a hopeless dependence on humans. In 1931, the naturalist Francis Pitt scoffed that dogs lacked intelligence because the rigorous tests imposed by nature, including that of ability to get a living, have been eliminated by human protection. In 1971, the veterinarian Michael Fox went so far as to call dogs canis over familiaris, arguing that domestication had resulted in psychosomatic symptoms such as depression and anorexia nervosa, asthma, diarrhea, convulsions, or paralysis of the hind limbs. In the 1950s, cognitive experiments began to show the sophistication of animal intelligence. By the 1980s, a study found that dolphins could mimic computer sounds, then use these new sounds to label real-world objects. Pigeons could categorize objects from two-dimensional photographs. And of course, our relatives, the great apes, were found to be so mentally dexterous that their skills bordered on humans. But when it came to dogs, the loudest message was overwhelmingly static. There is almost nothing about dogs in the cognitive literature from the 1950s all the way to 2000. Then suddenly there was an explosion in the field of dog cognition, spanning the fields of psychology, anthropology, and neuroscience. And I'm going to have to truncate this article, but after all the psychological experiments and all that, the bottom line is most dogs are not required to do anything at all except love us, and this they do very well. I hope you have a dog that loves you and that you can love, and if not, maybe adopt one or find someone with a dog. Well, we have come to the end of today's episode of Teen Magazines. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Anika Gal, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleradioreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Make it a great week. See you next time.